Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicles Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Moira O'Neill and joining me on the show today are my colleagues Leonora Walters and Kate Bearley. We're also delighted to have Investors Chronicles economist Chris Dillo on the telephone. Hi Chris.
Hello.
Hello. In today's show we're going to discuss the top funds and trust stories of 2015 and we'll also look at the best performing funds and trusts of the year. And Chris is going to give us his Christmas wish list for new financial products. And he'll also help us explain how to improve a substantial portfolio with 100 holdings or so. But first, December is traditionally the month in which we are bombarded with financial forecasts for the year ahead. And in this week's bumper Christmas issue, we're giving lots and lots of forecasts and including the views of many fund managers from the Investors Chronicles top 100 funds. You can go and read those in the magazine. I do advise it. They're really interesting. But Chris, are forecasts reliable? You've looked into this, haven't you?
Yeah, sadly not. And it's not just in economics that this is the case. I mean, this time a year ago, economists over-predicted inflation this year. And what they tend to do is they tend to mispredict recessions. Recessions are, to a very large extent, unpredictable. And that's been the case ever since we started looking at the subject. So it's not just a product of the financial crisis of 2008-2009. And it's not just economists who get things wrong. And you think back a year ago, nobody was predicting that the Tories would win an outright majority at the general election. Nobody was predicting Jeremy Corbyn would become Labour leader. Nobody was predicting that Chelsea would be involved in a relegation scrap this season. So it seems to be that in pretty much anything, forecasts are prone to be wildly wrong.
We love making them. Why do we want to read them? Why are we interested? We all kind of know that we're probably not going to get it right, but it's still a really interesting, exciting sort of process to think about the year ahead and what might happen, isn't it?
Yeah, well, this is pretty much as old as the human race. I mean, we have always wanted soothsayers and witch doctors to give us the illusion of predictability and the false comfort that we can predict the future. But the fact is that we can't. And a big reason for this is simply that what happens in the future depends upon complex interactions between people, the outcomes of which can't be predicted. So I suspect that the future is inherently unpredictable. And it's also the case that forecast errors arise from many cognitive biases. But even if we were to cleanse ourselves of those biases, it'd still be the case that the future is to a large extent unpredictable. And I think what people should do is, rather than rely upon forecasts, they should rely upon rules which have a great track record of working.
So here we're talking about looking to the past, aren't we? And looking for patterns, which you're very, very good at.
Oh, thank you. The only rule I use is the sell in May, buy on Halloween rule. Now, the only forecast that is based on is the assumption that the future will, on average, resemble the past. You know, which is probably as weak an assumption as one can make. But I really don't think one need to worry about where the FTSE is going. And what most of us do is just have a weighting in equities and a weighting in safe assets that reflects our attitude to risk. And it would be very silly to base one's asset allocation upon a precise forecast.
So how is buying on Halloween working out for you so far, Chris? It's done all right, yes.
So far, not too great. The FTSE 100 was about 6,350. On Halloween, it's around 6,100 now. Mm-hmm. But we've still got, 4.5 months to go, and that's quite a long time to recoup what is quite a small loss.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm by no means panicking.
No, that sounds good.
And the sell in May saved me from quite a substantial loss.
Ah, right. So your quid's in then, so it's all working out nicely. We've sort of been looking forward, but now let's look to the past because, you know, this is the time of year when we look back at the top stories of the year so far. And Kate has been looking at the top fun stories. What have been your favourites, Kate?
Yeah, well, obviously there's been a lot to choose from. So in terms of active funds, I had a look at the ongoing battle at the Investment Association, the trade body for open-ended funds. So former chief executive Daniel Godfrey had been trying to persuade members to reform certain elements, particularly around fee transparency. But that didn't go well for him and he ended up ousted by some fund houses who were very unkeen on what he was proposing. Also, Alliance Trust, a major fight between activist shareholder Elliott Advisors and the board. Elliott was very unhappy about performance, the high discount to NAV and about losses Alliance Trust subsidiaries. In April, there was a kind of brief compromise and Alliance Trust added two of the board members that Elliott wanted. But then in October, the Trust announced that Catherine Garrett Cox was stepping down and it looks like it might continue to be slightly challenging there. Then in kind of happier news, I guess, Neil Woodford, who left Investco Perpetual in 2014 and set up his new fund. Now, by the end of the year, that fund was already kind of topping its sector. And by August, it had reached, August 2015, had reached 6.7 billion. So a similar size to the old, very successful fund he ran. Also this year, he launched New Trust Patient Capital. And demand has been so high for that that the IPO has increased from 500 to 800 million, making it the largest ever UK domiciled investment company IPO. And then just in individual trust news, we had bad times for BlackRock World Mining. It was already forced to write down securities in its Maramba mine, and that those had to be written off when London Mining collapsed at the end of last year. It was quite a high-profile news story at the time. And then this year it was also hit with exposure to a gold mine at Banro, and had to reduce the value of that investment. Also, either a bad or a good time, I guess, depending on what you think about Murray International, that trust fell to a discount for the first time in 5 years on the back of quite poor results. But, I mean, manager Bruce Sauer has a very good reputation, so I guess some people might be seeing that as an opportunity. And again, good and bad times for Scottish Mortgage. Had a really strong performance record and has been overwhelmed with demand, so it issued new shares. But it did say in its latest results that it's got concerns over the future of its dividend. Its revenue reserves are kind of dwindling, and it has warned they might have to cut that in the future. And then a really good time for Biotech Growth Trust, which turned 10 in 2015, and is the best performing investment trust over that period. And even after the sell-off, in fact, is still looking like the best. And then, so moving on to passive, a lot of the stories in passive, particularly around ETFs, were obviously around the launches of kind of new products and new trends. And currency hedging has been a major theme, particularly given QE and the weaker yen and the weaker euro. There were a lot of launches around that. And arguably that might have played out now. So maybe it's a little bit of a horse stable door thing. But that was a big concentration of launches. And we had a couple of very high profile, quite interesting niche products, which we analysed. One, the first Indian fixed income product, the Curry Bond. And also a cybersecurity ETF, which was launched on the back of a massively popular one in the US. So that'll be interesting to keep an eye on. And also, interestingly, low volatility ETFs, which have been a big theme in factor-based ETF investing. We had a look at the market crash in the summer and whether those had kind of proved their worth. And interestingly, they did prove their mettle. They really held up against, you know, normal ETFs or their kind of vanilla counterparts. So maybe that goes to show that you know, the hype surrounding those was worth it. And then we had a look at some sectors likely to be affected by a US rate rise, which has now happened. So we'll see if these predictions, I guess, were right. And those were emerging market debt and equity funds and fixed income ETFs, which we've also talked about quite a bit because there's been a lot of discussion about whether there are enough of those in the market and how they've been performing. Also in the magazine, we had to look at ETF price cuts, which I won't run through, but we've included those in this piece.
So it seems like there's been a lot of positive innovation with a few negative stories and also some nice positive active fund stories over the year. Decent year in the funds industry. And Leonora, in this week's magazine, you've been taking a look at what has actually performed best among funds and investment trusts over the year so far. Where should we have put our money in January?
Yeah, well, there were four really dominant themes across both investment trusts and open-ended fund. And these were Japan, Europe, UK and smaller companies, both in terms of the sectors that did best and the individual funds and investment trusts that did best. Now, there's some reasons for this, because I had a chat with quite a few analysts who've been looking back at things. And I think what they said was, you know, Europe and Japan have really benefited from quantitative easing in 2015, and there's expectations that they'll extend the programmes. And Japanese and European smaller companies obviously have more of a domestic focus than their large cap peers, so they're well positioned to capture this. I think European data is generally positive, consumer confidence is recovering, and the currency is quite weak, which is good for exporters. So, yeah, and it's a similar story with UK smaller companies. We had a good year, you know, earnings continue to grow. We're exposed to the UK economy, which is doing quite well at the moment, and they're not as sensitive to the stronger pound as some of their large cap peers. So I think those are the, let's say, the general drivers in this area. Perhaps another thing to mention is, as well, obviously one of the things that hasn't been so good this year is, you know, commodity stocks. And typically commodity stocks are more focused in the large cap indices. You know, perhaps another reason why smaller companies have done well. I think turning to, you know, what did particularly well, in among open-ended funds, the best performer was Legg Mason Japan Equity, and that rose 40% over the first 11 months of 2015. Now, this is, I mean, it's a good fund, regardless of, you know, what's gone on over these 11 months. It's got a good, strong, long-term record. But I think what one of the advisors pointed out was it is a hugely volatile fund. So before you jump in there, you know, thinking that it might do well, it has to be borne in mind that some years this fund absolutely shoots up and some years it absolutely plummets. But it seems over the long term that you have a bit more up and down, so it kind of stacks up to good numbers. In terms of investment trusts that did well, among the top 10 performers, quite a few UK investment trusts, and these include SVM UK Emerging Fund, JP Morgan Mid Cap, British and American, and Standard Life UK Smaller Companies. These all did quite well. I think, you know, going ahead, though, I mean, obviously we're going to have more on that in upcoming issues. I think people are reasonably confident Europe and Japan could do well. But in terms of style, some analysts have pointed out that certainly in terms of the UK funds, they have quite a growthy style. And this could go on for a while. But if interest rates do rise, which it might in the UK following the US rise, growth might not be as in vogue. But that's, you know, that's something a bit further out there.
Okay. Well, I mean, a lot of investors will be trying to reposition their portfolios at this time of year. And one which we'll be featuring in Portfolio Clinic is Rod, who's 55, who holds more than a few funds. And in fact, his £2.5 million portfolio, lucky him, is spread across more than 100 assets. Rod has said he wants to maximise growth in the run-up to retirement, but the over-diversification we felt was holding him back. Chris, you were one of the experts on this portfolio. And obviously lots of people will be thinking about how to rationalise their portfolio and arrange their assets better at this time of year. So what was your advice for Rod?
Well, one thing that really interested me about this portfolio was the background risks that he was taking on, in that he had quite big investments in Spanish property and also in private equity. Now, those assets expose him to particular risks. There's liquidity risk, the fact that you can't sell property or private equity very quickly at a decent price. There's also foreign exchange risk. If the euro collapses, then your Spanish property is worthless. And there's also cyclical risk. If we run into a recession, then private equity and property suffer. So one thing I think one should do when one is faced with risks like that is to use your financial assets to try and mitigate those risks. And depending on your risk aversion, this might argue for holding cash and bonds because these are liquid. But it also, I think, argues for having larger defensive stocks. And quite a few income funds actually offer that. I think it's very important when you're buying an income fund to check what exactly it holds, because some of them expose you to cyclical risk, for example, if they're heavily weighted in miners, but quite a few others have nice defensive exposure because they're holding the likes of tobacco and utility companies. And those can be very useful in mitigating market risk and liquidity risk.
But one of the suggestions for slimming down his portfolio and making it simpler was to concentrate on those defensives, wasn't it?
Yeah.
To make them the focus of the portfolio.
Yes, yes. In this particular case, where you're taking on cyclical risk through your other assets anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I like about defensives is that history tells us that around the world, they tend to outperform on average over the long run. So they're offering us something that shouldn't exist in theory, but which does exist in practice, namely relatively low risk, but relatively high return. And another thing he should do, given that background risk, and I don't normally recommend this because I think foreign exchange risk is entirely unpredictable, but I think there is a case for perhaps having some weighting in US dollar assets simply to mitigate the risk that the euro declines and therefore he loses a packet on his Spanish property.
And he had a huge amount in Spanish property, a development worth £800,000, he said. So
yeah.
That is a big chunk of his assets. But shouldn't investors have US exposure anyway?
As a rule. I mean, one way to simplify your portfolio is to have in mind that your default position should be to hold a global index tracker fund. You know, because if you're the average investor, then you should hold what the average investor holds. And the average investor, by definition, holds the global market. So yes, one should be exposed to the US. But most of us are exposed to the US, even if we don't own a single US dollar of US shares, simply because if the US market declines, then so too will the UK one.
Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, that correlation there is sort of like working like an exposure anyway. I was going to ask you as well, Chris, about your ideas for your wish list of financial products that should exist but don't, because this is actually sadly my last podcast for Investors Chronicle before I move on to Pastors New. And in reflecting on my 8 years here, I was actually thinking about how little real innovation we've actually seen over that time. So, Chris, what would be top of your wish list for next year and new products?
Well, possibly at the top, I would put house price futures.
Mm-hmm.
Young people are complaining rightly that they can't get onto the housing ladder. Older people who are thinking of trading down might want to reduce their exposure to housing. And therefore, there's a natural opportunity to trade. What should happen in theory is that younger people should be able to buy a house price future that protects them against the risk that house prices will rise and so become even more unaffordable. And people who are thinking of trading down, say because they want to retire in a few years' time, should want to go short of house price futures. So, in effect, insuring themselves against the risk that house prices fall. So there should, in theory, be quite an active market in house price futures, and there isn't.
So why doesn't that exist? Why doesn't the industry innovate in a way that would benefit real people?
Well, there's a problem with innovation in general, not just in financial markets, and that is that it's very, very difficult for producers to actually capture the full fruits of innovation. There was a wonderful paper written by William Nordhaus at Yale University 10 years ago, in which he showed that of the innovation that's happened since about 1945, very, very little of it has translated into a rise in profits. the real beneficiaries of innovation are customers and companies that come along later and replicate past innovations. And because companies know this, they have a strong disincentive to innovate. And what the financial services industry has done is that it's come up with products that it can sell rather than products that genuinely benefit people. And the products that can sell are normally high-cost, actively managed funds rather than more useful financial assets. And that problem is exacerbated by the fact that financial assets, to a large extent, are useful insofar as there's a big liquid market in them. But trying to get a financial product from scratch up to active and liquid is incredibly difficult, and it's not something that any individual firm can do on its own.
Yeah, I mean, one of the products you mentioned was the social care insurance, so being able to insure against living a long time and having to have a long stay in a care home, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, those kinds of, there were a few products around, but I'm guessing about 10 years ago now, but the market was very small and dwindled away. And, you know, it just seems that there's a huge need for that kind of product, but they people said that they couldn't sell them very easily because people didn't want to think about that future ahead of them.
Yeah, this is another problem with innovation. Sometimes you can be too far ahead of yourself. I suspect that nowadays, when people are feeling rather gloomier and rather older, there might be more of a market there, but people have been scared off from innovating by their experience several years ago. You know, it is a genuinely difficult problem of actually marketing a product from scratch, and it's become harder down the years because the public are, let's face it, rightfully very sceptical about whether they're getting value for money from the financial services sector.
And we encourage them to do just that at Investors Chronicle, don't we? So we're always talking about fund fees and value for money and controlling costs and checking whether a product has value. So I suppose it's just a natural state of affairs. I'm trying not to be too philosophical on my last podcast. But anyway, thank you very much to my colleagues, Kate Bearley, Leonora Walters and Chris Dillow. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. But if you want to keep in touch with me after I leave Investors Chronicle, then you can follow me on Twitter, where I am very simply at Moira O'Neill. You can read more about the top fund stories of 2015, predictions for 2016, whether you believe them or not, and the other stories that we've discussed in this show in today's issue of Investors Chronicle. Thank you very much for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.